Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast by radio amateurs with a focus on homebrew electronics. We get together on the internet to swap ideas about radio construction projects. Our website is www.soldersmoke.com. Please send feedback to soldersmoke, that's one word, at yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke.
Hey, good morning. It's the 17th of January, 2008, 0615 local here in Rome, Italy. And welcome to Solder Smoke 74. Welcome also to Solar Cycle 24. You guys may have noticed, as I did, that earlier this month there were messages on QRPL and other internet sites indicating that the new solar cycle has officially kicked off. Three cheers for Solar Cycle 24. I'm hoping that I'll be able to be active at the peak part of this cycle. I don't know where I'll be, but I hope to be on the air. I was looking at some of the charts and noticed that I was born at the peak of solar cycle 19, which was also, as I think I've mentioned here, during the International Geophysical Year, IGY. So, I looked at the, it's interesting to look at the chart for the solar cycles and see where you were and where you were active and what kind of rig you were running at the different phases in the cycle. Anyway, I am solar cycle 19. Maybe we should all start identifying ourselves that way in the, at least in the signature blocks of our emails. Kind of like your ham radio vintage. Excuse me. I think speaking of history and ham radio vintage, there was something that I wanted to mention in the last issue of Solder Smoke, but I somehow missed it. Let's stand by as I go for the reading glasses here. It's a nice message that came across the QRPL mailing list regarding. It was in response to Michael Rainey's work with the really super low power QRP transmitters. And this is a little bit of looking back at the history of transistors and ham radio. I'll read you parts from the message here. It says, Dear Mike and gang, it was about this time of year 55 years ago that George Rose, K2AH, made the first amateur transistor transmission with a single transistor homebrew rig. It, too, was a germanium transistor. Rose measured an input power of 24 milliwatts and estimated the radiated power at somewhere around 50 microwatts. His transistor was an early RCA point contact type. Rose was an engineer with RCA and led the advanced development group at RCA's newly formed semiconductor division. He took one of the team's specially formed transistors home to play with, hooked up a simple keyed oscillator that multiplied a 16 megahertz crystal to its ninth overtone frequency and fed the signal to a 12-element beam. All right. His first contact was with Tommy Thomas, W2UK, who lived 25 miles away. He went on to have two more contacts that night with W2KNI and W2DPB. Forrest Gerke, a neighbor of Rose's, told me that after Rose retired, he gradually lost his eyesight but remained active as a ham radio operator. In early 2003, Wes Hayward, W7ZOI, published, quote, "The First Transistorized Transmitter 50 Years Later," that's the title of the article, on his website. He says, but I can't find it there now. In his paper, Wes analyzed Rose's design, designed a similar circuit that used a single 2N3NO4 in the same configuration, and gave the design for his own first transistorized transmitter. It used a single 2N274, an early transmitter by Laird Campbell, W1CUT, that ran 50 milliwatt output, and Bob Coulter's transistor-less solid-state transmitter that used a 1N3712 tunnel diode. As you can see, your Flea Power transmitter's performance was quite an accomplishment. It has an interesting history as well. Congratulations. Yeah, indeed. Thanks for that, Stu. And thanks to Michael and all the folks who have moved on from germanium and are now into tunnel diodes. I think it's really interesting. It's caused me to pull out the books and study up on the mysterious quantum operations of the tunnel diodes. I don't fully understand it yet, but that's okay because nobody does, as Richard Feynman so kindly points out in his books on QED and on all things quantum. He advises not to try to really understand it because, well, he doesn't, and he won the Nobel Prize for it. So anyway, I'm really interested in all the tunnel diode work, and there you have a message looking back at the earliest days of this kind of stuff. As I mentioned, Michael has moved on to tunnel diodes, and his website has all kinds of interesting stuff on it. I particularly liked the pictures that Michael had up there. He has on his site, and I'll put something this on the Google Earth site. I mean, on my gadgeteer.us site, of his underground Radio Shack. I found this inspirational because I've been feeling kind of constrained here. The Rome Shack is quite small, and I was thinking, man, I'm really crowded in here. But when I looked at Michael's underground shack, I feel like I'm living in spacious above ground luxury here. So it made me feel better about the size of my shack. Of course, Michael's is two levels. He's got the supply and part storage one level below. But I thought it was really, really neat, really innovative, and it's great that he could heat the whole thing with one 150-watt light bulb. So that's a good job there, Michael, and keep up the good work with the tunnel diodes. If I get on the air from Rome, we'll have to try to make maybe the first transatlantic two-way tunnel diode contact. we'll see. I mentioned anniversaries in the solar cycle here. There's another one that came up. It's related to something that we've discussed here on Solder Smoke on and off over the years, and that's the Mars exploration rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. Just wanted to point out that these two golf cart-sized rovers were sent to Mars, and they had a planned lifespan of about 90 days, and they were struggling to squeeze as much science as possible during that 90-day period. Well, they just passed their four-year anniversary mark. They're both still active, both continuing to drive around on the surface. And, well, congratulations to the rovers. We hope they keep going. Well, each of them has developed over the years their own kind of mechanical problems. But they're it's like, I guess it's sort of like some of those commercials for the the bunnies that don't stop. They're still going across Mars, and it's really interesting. I think one of the things that always kind of captured my attention was the fact that when winter comes on Mars and the sun is low on the horizon, the way they deal with that is they park the rovers on a hill specially selected with a slope that creates kind of as close as possible to a 90-degree angle with the incoming solar rays to catch all those photons. So a pretty neat way to deal with winter on Mars. We wish both Opportunity and Spirit a good winter season there on Mars. Okay, we're in outer space. We have to stay here for a while, I guess. And I think I might have mentioned in the last one, or maybe I didn't. Maybe it came up since the last one. Here it is. SETI wants you. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence is looking for volunteers to help participate in this colossal effort. I was going to say, I guess you could say galactic, not intergalactic. This colossal galactic effort. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence, it's a real serious operation, and they've recently put to use a new set of software developed out, I think it's developed out in Berkeley. Yeah, it is Berkeley. And it allows a more efficient connection to kind of shared computer networks. The idea is, whereas your computer sits there at night doing nothing, if you participate in this project, they can hook up to your computer and make use of your hardware to do some of the data processing, the massive amounts of data processing that are required for a project like SETI. And I've been kind of intrigued by this. It's been around for a long time. The new software, I think, makes it easier to do. And, of course, now that we all have 24/7 high-speed Internet connections, I figured I would give it a try. I downloaded all the software. It was a piece of cake, no problem at all. I set it up. I selected the parameters. I have it set up so that it starts up at about 11 o'clock at night when I am completely horizontal and processes receives and processes data for the SETI folks till about 5 o'clock in the morning, at which point I am making the coffee and heading into the shack. And then it shuts down, so it doesn't bother me at all. It has no real impact on the speed of the connection or anything like that. And you get some very neat screensavers. The thing I find most intriguing about it, as a radio amateur, is that when they give you the screensaver showing what your computer has been working on, they tell you exactly when and where the data came from. They even give you what frequency they were looking at and where in the sky the antenna was pointing and what antenna they were using. For example, the first set of data that that my computer worked on, well, not I worked on, but the computer did it, was picked up by the Arecibo antenna in Puerto Rico on the 31st of January 2007. They were looking at around 1.4 gigahertz. I think that's the standard, what they call the waterhole frequency. And you get a nice display there showing time and frequency and whatever. And they show the little spikes that come up. Of course, almost all of it is noise. But we're looking for that one little bit that is not noise. And I looked at that first packet, and I briefly thought that I could see some guy calling CQ in there, but no, it was just my ham radio imagination. And so we're continuing to listen on 1.4 gigahertz at night. So anyway, you might find that interesting. It's kind of a fun thing to do. It's kind of I just find it neat that kind of as I sleep, the computer is searching data that's coming in through the Arecibo dish at 1.4 gigs. Very very interesting. I have information on how to sign up for it on the Gadgeteer News website. All right, let's get down to the main topic, one of the main topics of this issue of Solder Smoke. You know, it's been said, and I think with a whole lot of validity, that the book Experimental Methods in RF Design, when combined with the free software program LT Spice, together they constitute a kind of a BSEE program in a can. That's the way somebody put it. That you really can teach yourself quite a lot by using EMRFD in conjunction with the simulator program LT Spice. I think I would like to add a third element. You know, any good education program has mentors and teachers in it. So I think to this little statement that EMRFD and LT Spice together make up a BSEE program in a can, I'd like to throw something else into the can, and that would be QRPL, because it's really great as you're struggling to understand some of these concepts in electronics and radio and physics. It's really great to have access to lots of people who are really, really very well informed on the topic and who are willing to take time out to explain to a fellow amateur what's going on and where he or she is going wrong in their efforts to understand this complicated stuff. In the last few issues of Solder Smoke, I've been talking about my efforts to understand, to really understand mixers. And over the Christmas holiday, I had a few days off, so I had some additional time to sit around and contemplate how little I really know about mixers. And to try to improve my understanding of this really key bit of circuitry. When you think about it, we've got mixers in almost every single one of our transmitters and receivers. Michael's tunnel diode rigs might be the exception, but we really have them in all of our rigs. And I just never really have been satisfied with my understanding of what's going on in these things. I mean, I know that you take the two frequencies and they go in, and I know that the trigonometry says that you get some indifferences out. Yep. But I just don't understand how that happens. How does that little diode know how to multiply? And why is it that when you multiply, you end up with the sum and the difference? All these kind of questions. These are the kind of things that keep a radio amateur up at night. Anyway, during the Christmas holidays, I turned to QRPL in an effort to confirm or refute some of my understandings on this subject, and I got a lot of really great help from a lot of guys who took a lot of time to write some really very lengthy and lucid explanations of where I was wrong and where I might be on the right path. I'll tell you what was going on during this particular period. I have always been trying to get kind of a intuitive level, kind of almost graphical, a graphical kind of understanding of how the these frequencies combine in the mixer to produce sum and difference frequencies. And in many of the books, especially the older books that I've come across, they present three kind of very neat graphs, one showing the first input frequency, the second, below it, they show the second input frequency, and below those, they show the resulting output. And in a lot of these graphs, what they do is they're just summing up. They're just adding the two frequencies together. And what they display is a waveform in which the kind of the outer envelope of the waveform clearly varies at the difference frequency. And what's going on here is that the sum, you're getting what they call constructive and destructive interference between the two waveforms. And there'll be points where both of them will be at peak voltage. And at that point, they're adding to each other. You'll get other points where one is at peak positive and one is at peak negative, in which they null each other out. And as a result, you get what looks like the generation of a difference frequency. This is frequently used in some of the books as sort of a simple explanation of how mixers operate. And it's similar to the experiment that many of us did back in high school physics labs. When you take two tuning forks close in frequencies, you get them both ringing, and you bring them together, and they kind of produce the beat frequency. You can hear it kind of coming in and out of phase. This is a very familiar phenomenon in music and acoustics, and it was, I think, discovered by an Italian musician, and he called it il terzo suono, the third sound that comes when you take and combine two different frequencies. Anyway, all these kind of simplistic, acoustical-based graphic explanations, I thought, were getting me closer to understanding, at kind of a gut level, why the diodes and the trigonometry combine to produce some indifference frequencies. I asked about this on QRPL, and I got a variety of different responses, and some guys indicated that, well, this is not a form of mixing, and I was a couple of responses came in saying that no, it can't be mixing, because for mixing you absolutely have to have a nonlinear device. And a couple of the responses kind of indicated that, well, okay, yeah, you're hearing a difference product, But that's only because the human ear is nonlinear and mixing is taking place in the human ear. One or two of the responses indicated that the air itself might be nonlinear. And so I started thinking, well, let me check some of this out. Let me see what's going on. So I took two audio generators on the workbench and fed the output of both into a little simple resistor network. And I put a scope on it, and I put a little audio amplifier on it so I could watch it and listen to it. And anyway, I moved the two frequencies together, and both on the scope and on the speaker, sure enough, you could hear this beat frequency coming as the two frequencies came closer together. So I asked myself, don't we have kind of a mixer here? After all, we have two frequencies. We have an audio. They're combining, and there's what looks like and sounds like a different frequency being generated. It's not the result of some weird lack of linearity in my ear, because I can see it right there on the scope. So it's not even the air. There's no air involved. It's going by electrical connection to the oscilloscope. Anyway, so this got me thinking. I also pulled out LT Spice and put the whole thing on LT Spice and modeled it there, and got comfortingly pretty much the exact same results. So I'm confused here, because all the books say you need a nonlinear circuit, yet I seem to be getting a difference product without any apparent nonlinear circuit involved, just resistors. And this deepened my confusion. See, I thought I had understood mixers via these three very neat, easy to understand graphs that a number of the books have provided. But anyway, my question went out to the group, and I said, okay, am I on the right path here or not? And it turns out not. No. I was not looking at mixer action. And I thought I had it, but I didn't. And I'm just scrolling through my notes here, because some of the answers that came back were particularly illuminating on this. The guy who really set me straight was Tom, V-E-3-M-E-O. And he made it very clear. He said to me, Bill, the beat note that you hear between the two tuning forks is not a new signal. It is just the period between the constructive-destructive interference due to the superposition or addition of the two signals. You cannot separate the beat frequency signals from the source signals, because subtracting one of the source signals from the waveform leaves you merely with the other. And here's the key line from Tom that set me straight. You can't hear the beat without hearing both forks singing. Indeed, that's it. That's why this is not a mixer. What we're listening to here is entirely separate. It's just kind of an electrical equivalent of something well known in acoustics, what Giuseppe Tarzini called il terzo suono. But that's not what goes on in mixers, because in a mixer, one of the key differences is that the resulting signals need to be extractable. You need to be able to put a filter on there and pull it out. That's what this is all about, and that's why what I was looking at was not a mixer. Now, continuing my effort to understand this stuff, as I dug through the literature, I found something that I found very, very illuminating, and that I think is probably the best thing going in terms of providing a graphical representation of what goes on in a mixer and how a mixer produces sum and difference frequencies. And it comes from that great source of radio electronic knowledge and wisdom, SPRAT, the Journal of the GQRP Club. In their issue number 99, summer of 1999, they have an article by Leon Williams, VK2DOB. It was originally printed in the VK CW Operators QRP Club magazine called Low Key. And the title of Leon's article is CMOS Mixer Experiments. And he has he's experimenting with some 74HC4066 chips, using them as a mixer. But he's got a line in here that really, really caught my attention. Leon says the following. It says, generally, mixer theory is explained with the use of complicated maths. But with switching type mixers, it can be very intuitive to study them with simple waveform diagrams. Three cheers for Leon. He goes on to provide the schematic of his circuit and some very detailed waveform diagrams that, for the first time for me, show how a switching mixer generates the sum and difference frequencies that we all use every day in our circuits. And now, as he points out, the switching mixers are kind of a special case of mixers. Not all the mixers we use are switching types, but they're really just a kind of an extreme example. Whatever they illustrate does give you insights into how other mixers work. So, with the permission of Spratt from Tony Fishpool of Spratt, who checked with with George Dobbs G3RJV, they kindly allowed me to put on my website the info from Leon Williams' article. And if you go to the Gadgeteer.news site, if you want to see what I'm talking about, you'll see the chart that I found particularly illuminating, and the circuit diagram for Leon's mixer. I have those two. That's it right now. So I think you'll see what I'm talking about, and please take a look. Let me know what you think. I think it's a fascinating topic, and let me send my thanks out to Leon for that really illuminating set of charts. Thanks also to all the mentors out there who helped. Appreciate it. And three cheers for QRPL, something that's just been added to the BSEE in a can program. Great. Hey, another thing came across QRPL that I thought was kind of fun this weekend. I think Michael Rainey was the one who started the current wave of poetry on QRPL. Another bit of poetry came up. Somebody posted a poem that Rudyard Kipling wrote from Afghanistan days about the use of a heliograph in the Afghan hills. The British forces there were apparently using heliographs. I didn't know, and they were using heliographs with Morse. And there's a great Kipling poem out there about one lovesick Morse operator out there on a hilltop station with a heliograph, who taught his new bride back in town to read Morse so he could send her messages. it's great fun, and if you just Google Kipling heliograph Afghanistan, the poem will pop up. It's also been on QRPL. I'll try to remember to put it up on Gadgeteer News, but I'm not too good in that area, so. Well, anyway, see if you can find it. It's a lot of fun. Hey, just before we came into the Solder Smoke studio here, I saw some kind of sad message. Well, yeah, it's a sad message. The RSGB magazines had for many, many years a really wonderful set of articles, a column every week called Tech Topics by Pat Hawker. And it's been my favorite part of the magazine. There's been compilation books put out. I've got all of them. Look it up on my shelf here. All four editions, and covering, I think, four decades of the work. It's really been great. And I think Pat has decided to stop writing the column. I think he's come to that point where he doesn't want to have to do it every month. I just want to thank him for all the wonderful columns. I've learned so much from his writings, and I'm sure everybody else has too. And we're going to miss it. But I think the only compensation we have here is that the compilations are all available, and I think they deserve a spot on the bookshelves of all Solder Smoke listeners, and really go out and get a hold of those books. They're just tremendous sources of kind of insight and wisdom on the radio arts. So thanks Pat for all the years of all the great columns. Let's see. That brings us to the point of the show. Cue the gong.
Solder Smoke mailbag.
All right, Solder Smoke mailbag. We get quite a bit of mail on the mixer topic, and I've already I mentioned Tom. Nick, WA5BDU, was a really great help. Alan, let me get his call here. Alan and I have been corresponding for so long. Yeah, VK2ZAY. Alan had put together a really great website on this topic. It's called Alan's Lab, Me and My Geeky Hobbies. He's got he put together a website called Nonlinearity Harmonic Generation and Frequency Mixing at www.vk2zay.net. You can find it there, and it's really great. It provides a lot of really useful insight on the mixer topic. Richard G3ZTB has provided some really terrific professional level. I feel like I'm taking advantage of some really top level. I know I am, of top level university instruction here. So thanks very much, Richard, for all your kind messages. Looking through the list, let me see here. Phil WB7AEI, really great stuff. Sent me some really kind of really great messages. With Phil's messages, I had so many kind of light bulb on moments. For example, I had never really understood balanced modulators or balanced mixtures. I knew how the balance took place, but I didn't know how the balance and the mixing took place simultaneously. And Phil has a great way of explaining this stuff. And he just pointed out that you look at the balanced modulator, you can look at it in a certain sense as a switching mixer. It's in balance, there's no output. Then the other signal comes along and it's switched in and out of balance by the other signal. For me, the light bulb went off there. So, Phil, thanks for all those light bulb moments that you sent via email. Ron, G4GXO, sent some great messages. And of course, I mentioned earlier the messages from Mike, AA1TJ, great and inspirational messages on this topic. Thanks to all. On other subjects, we got a nice email from our friend Ramakrishnan in Bangalore, and he points out that on YouTube there is a new video called The Secret History of Silicon Valley, and it includes a significant portion of the video. Includes a bit about Terman, somebody else who's on all of our bookshelves, and about his role in wartime electronic warfare operations during World War II, and the role of Harvard Radio Labs and the birth of Silicon Valley and Stanford. So definitely, I'll try to get that up on the internet too, but on the website also, but. If not, just if you go to YouTube and search for The Secret History of Silicon Valley, it's about a 50-minute video. I think you guys would enjoy it. Wes, W7ZOI, has updated a portion of his website with shack photos, and I found them inspirational. And so I suggest you check that out, and you'll see some really interesting shack photos. I wanted to wrap up this week's segment with part two of my conversation with Andy ZS680Y, a boat anchor, old radio enthusiast from South Africa. We had a really nice conversation with him not long ago, and people seem to enjoy listening to the first part, so we'll put up part two, and there may be part three here, and hopefully we'll be talking to Andy again and get some more info on what he's up to in the fascinating world of restoring old radios in South Africa. So here we go with part two of a conversation with ZS680Y.
Yeah, and Zero HBR ZS680Y. Yes, fine, Bill. And always nice to meet up with somebody who has an interest in these old rigs, and absolutely great. I've been privileged to have a lot of acquaintances who work with this stuff. My history with the Collins side is that one of my suppliers, I work for a company, I'm a quality manager for a company that does metal forgings, and we manufacture components for the automotive industry. And one of our suppliers who I went to see one day asked me what this antenna was on the back of my car, and I told him I'm a radio ham. And he said to me, oh, you've got to come to my house. I've got two old radios lying there in my garage, which a friend of mine asked me to keep for him, and this has been 10 years, and these things have just been lying in my garage. And the guy has never come back to fetch them, and I don't even know what's happened to him anymore. And often when people say that to you, you sort of get this picture in your mind of some really old, ancient, decrepit piece of equipment that's been left there. And he dragged me off to his GTH, which wasn't far from where he worked, and opened up his garage, and there sat this Collins S-Line, the 37 and the 75 receiver, 75 S3 and the 32 S3 transmitter. And I sort of looked at him and said, oh, well, I tried to control my emotions very much. I looked at him and I said, oh, those are Collins radios. They're quite old. They're all valve radios. He said, oh, so you know them? I said, yes, they're amateur radio. And he said, well, do you want them? And I sort of had to keep myself intact, you see, and said, well, if your friend's not going to come back and fetch them, what do you want for them? He said, no, you can take them. They've been lying here for years. And that was the start of my Collins collection. I took them home, and wow, they were really dirty. They had been left lying for 10 years. They had been transported around when this guy moved and left lying in his garage, and they had a greasy layer inside them. I actually stripped this thing down and bathed it in hot soapy water, and then in benzene to clean it out. And yeah, and today they stand in my shack as very much working models. And of course, I have a KWM2A and a 30L1. And fortunately, in South Africa, the Collins guys, there are very few and far between, and the blokes don't seem to place very much value on on these old rigs, which is great for us who use them. You know, I very often look at the price of Collins equipment in the States, and even dollar wise, it's really expensive. Never mind looking at the exchange rate. But even dollar to rand-wise, they're expensive. And I look at what we pay for some of the Collins equipment that we buy here from guys who are ready to move into smaller townhouse complexes and or into old-age homes, and they give up their equipment, and they don't ask very much for it. So it's fantastic, and it makes collecting of these things a lot easier. All fine on the on your Hammerland, yeah. Those, as you say, wonderful old receivers as well. And we have a few guys who we have some of them too. I have one particular guy who collects Hammerland equipment, and you can't talk to him about anything. He's got just about everything that was brought into South Africa ever. He has on a shelf somewhere in his shack. And all being restored to their former glory, all working perfectly. And that's what I like about some of these guys, is they won't just clean up the outside and put it on a shelf. They actually restore them to their former glory, and they become real working rigs. So it's a good hobby, isn't it? And I tell you something, I think it's much easier to work on old valve equipment than it is to work on some of the modern stuff. I've had the bottom off of my ICOM 706, and I just looked at it and thought, wow, I will never stick my fingers in there. There's no voltage there that's going to burn the ends of my fingertips off, but I would rather not play around with that micro technology. Give me valves any day. And the old hard wiring system, as you spoke about with the HT37, much easier to follow, much easier to fix, and to me, a lot more pleasure out of getting them up and working. So it's great, isn't it? And all fine. I wonder what other equipment you have in storage there, Bill. And I suppose one day you will eventually move back to the States and get yourself set up there. M0HBR, ZS680Y.
ZS680Y, M0HBR. Okay, Andy, real good. Well, I'm joined here by my son, Billy. He just woke up. He's 10 years old. And he gets involved in all kinds of radio, electronic, and laser adventures here in the shack with me. And he's just waking up with me here now. Yeah, the Collins gear. You know, I think having struggled with the Heathkit HW101, I came to the conclusion that it just doesn't age well. You know, when they really tried to save money in building these transceivers, they cut a lot of corners in a lot of areas. I think a lot of times they used resistors that were not of sufficient wattage, and over time that causes trouble. The other thing that that they did was a lot of really cheap plastic in those rigs, and the plastic doesn't age well. It gets very dried out and brittle. And I used to joke about the HW101 that I would have mechanical problems with the reduction drive on the main tuning capacitor. I couldn't figure out what it was, and somebody told me to put some new oil in there. So I put some oil in the reduction drive, and the problem went away. And then a while later, they have this little arrangement to align the tuning dial with the actual frequency of the main oscillator. So you have to push this button on the front, and then you turn the dial, and you line up so that the frequency readout dial is actually lined up with the frequency of the oscillator. But they have the mechanical arrangement. They call it the clutch. There's actually a clutch in there that causes the dial to disengage momentarily from the tuning cap. And I went in there one morning, and I pushed the little clutch button, and I heard this really disheartening kind of crack, plastic breaking sound inside. And sure enough, the clutch had broken on me. So I had to kind of fabricate my own replacement plastic part. And I sat back one day and I looked at this thing. I said, you know, I've changed the oil on this thing, and now I've changed the clutch. This is this is a really high maintenance piece of gear. And I kind of came to the conclusion that it would have been smarter, if it was possible, to start out working on a piece of gear like the S line or the KWM2. It was built with quality from the beginning, because I can imagine the guys who work on Collins gear don't face those kinds of kind of economical construction-based problems. The only piece of Collins gear I ever had was I had at one point, coming out of the Dominican Republic, an old friend of mine gave me a Collins 310, I think it was a 310A exciter.
It was one that kind of fed the big rack type equipment, and I had it, and it was following me around. And I kind of realized that I was never going to work on this thing. It really wasn't my area of interest. I wasn't going to go deep into the Collins business. I wasn't going to get the big rack type AM transmitter. So I put it up on eBay, and it was amazing. I thought I was going to sell it for, you know, a couple hundred dollars, but it stirred up a bit of a bidding war on eBay, and some guy out in Silicon Valley paid a truly what I thought unusual amount of money for it. So that was kind of interesting, an interesting bit of exposure to the deep pockets world of Collins collectors. My son's name is Billy. Billy, he's like I said, he's 10. What else was I going to mention? Oh yeah, you asked what I have in storage. Let's see. Just off the top of my head, I have a Heathkit DX60. At least one Heathkit DX40. I have the HT37. I have a whole bunch of kind of Heathkit Benton Harbor lunch boxes. What else? I have a Hammerland HQ100, the general coverage shortwave receiver. I really like that rig. Very, very simple little receiver, but the shortwave stations always sound real nice. And I've had to do a lot of work on it because it was pretty much destroyed by power line surges and nearby lightning strikes in the Dominican Republic. So I got it and it was really in bad shape, and I've gradually got it back in condition. I have a Heathkit VF1. The VFO, same VFO circuit that they used in the DX100 transmitter. And Andy, the rig that I really want, that one of these days I'm going to get and put back on the air, is the Heathkit DX100. I had one of those when I was a kid. I let it get away from me. That's the quintessential boat anchor's transmitter, Andy. I think that's the rig that caused them to coin the term boat anchor. So one of these days I'm going to get a DX100 and fire it up on AM on 75 meters. Be great fun. ZS680Y, M0HBR.
M0HBR, ZS680Y. Sorry, you caught me with a mouthful of cereal here. I'm sitting munching away on my breakfast this morning. And Billy, very good morning to you. And see, your old man's also got you interested in the electronic side there. And hopefully that you'll carry on the traditions of your dad. You'll certainly have some wonderful old radios to collect if you're interested in that kind of thing. But one actually wonders about, we talk often about this, about the youth in South Africa and how to get them involved in amateur radio when they have things like the internet, cell phones, SMSs, all this kind of thing. How do you get these people interested in amateur radio? So I think for people who start off at a young age in electronics, it may be a lot easier, but it's quite a difficult thing. And of course in South Africa there are nowhere near as many hams as what there are in the States. I think at last count we had something like 3,000 hams in the whole of South Africa, which is not many compared to the States. You probably find that one of your what would call it, almost like a province, one of your states themselves would have as many hams as that. So it becomes quite difficult. And fine, on your collection there, well, that sounds great. I'm not familiar with the DX100 at all, the Heathkit DX100, but I shall certainly go and have it. You know, I love talking to people about these things, and then I sort of make mental notes about some of their rigs which I must look up, and then I'll go along to Rigbix and have a look and look these rigs up and actually see what they were like, so that I have a good idea in my mind about them. And if anybody ever mentions it again, then at least I always find it easier to remember pictures of these things than I do to actually remember specifications about them. So I shall certainly have a look at look up that one. As I say, I'm not too familiar with it at all. And there were some tremendous boat anchors that were made, weren't there? And we don't see all of them. Fine on your mentioning the Collins stuff, yeah. And there were a lot of, I think in those days there were a lot of people, a lot of radio manufacturers who looked at the Collins equipment and thought, well, we can build something similar to that and make it a lot cheaper. And that was where a lot of the problems came in. But some of them still fine equipment. And then there were others, like Halicrafters, who said, well, you know, Collins is over there, we're going to build something totally different. And Hammerland as well, I mean, their equipment didn't even look anything like the Collins equipment, and a lot of them made their own stuff. And if I look at the Halicrafters equipment as well, also very, very solidly built to last, eh? Not like today where everything is enshrouded in plastic, as you say, and extremely difficult to work on. So I think that there must be a absolute treasure trove of equipment out there somewhere. There was an article that went around on the internet some time ago of a guy who bought a piece of property in Italy, and it had a big shed that had been sealed up, and they didn't know what was in the shed, and they couldn't get into it before he bought it. But he wanted the piece of property, and he purchased it, and then of course they found all these old cars, vintage cars. Well, looking at them, I have my boss is a classic car collector, and he sort of said to me, well, Andy, there's nothing much of real value. There's some wonderful old cars there in pretty good condition, but there's nothing much of real collectible value there. But still, you know, that's a treasure trove, I think, to somebody who might want to collect those sort of things. And I often think to myself, then somewhere out there must be a treasure trove of old boat anchors that some guy has put away in a shed somewhere, and somebody's going to discover these things one day, and it's going to be an absolute fortune's worth of old radios. But it would be wonderful to see that sort of thing. And I think when you get into these old collectibles and you start to look through them, you find that there are so many different types of around that as much as one would like to collect as many as you can, I think it becomes very difficult. First of all, space becomes a problem because of their size, and then you need a floor that's probably going to be steel reinforced if you're going to keep too many of them, which is not such a great idea. And I think it's great that a lot of guys sort of limit themselves and say, well, I'm going to collect Heathkit, or I'm going to collect Halicrafters, and I'm going to collect Collins. And to me, it really makes no difference what it is that you have. It's just great that that you can get them working. And we have a lot of fun on our net, especially on our AM net. We have an AM net on Wednesday evenings, and that goes on for anything up to four and a half hours that we sit and play AM. We do music transmissions and all sorts of things. Then we have another much shorter one on a Saturday morning, which is only about 2 hours. But the guys really, really get into it and enjoy themselves. And as you said, AM is a wonderful old mode to work, isn't it? And I see you operate on 75 meters with it. Local conditions here, we normally operate on 80 and 40 with them. Of course, the music transmissions were only allowed to do on 80. So it's great stuff, and it's a wonderful hobby. M0HBR said here, 681.
Okay, Andy, great. Thanks very much. That was always great. We look forward to more of that conversation in our next episode of Solder Smoke. Listen, earlier on I mentioned some anniversaries. I'm sure many of you are aware that we're also approaching a very sad anniversary, and that's the one-year anniversary of the death of our friend Mike, KL7R. I was reminded of this not just by the time of the year and the approaching date, but I recently came across a ham radio blog. I think it's called 100 Pound DXer, in which the guy who writes the blog was talking about how sometimes the internet is presented as a very cold, impersonal, dehumanized place in which nobody really gets to know each other, and it's all just a bunch of ones and zeros and email messages and texts and all that, and there's no real human connection involved. He cited Mike's contribution to Solder Smoke as proof that that's not true, and he said that here Mike was somebody that he'd never met that lived in a completely different part of the world, yet through the podcasts that this fellow had come to really feel that Mike was a friend of his. And I think that was a very common experience for people who listened to Mike on Solder Smoke. I got another email from our friend Ramakrishnan in Bangalore, VU3 RDD. And I hope I got the call right there, Ramakrishnan. He remarked about how in the course of doing some technical web searches this week, he had plugged in the information that he was looking for into Google, and one of the first pages that came up happened to be one of the KL7R pages of our friend Mike. This caused Ramakrishnan to think that it's important, and I agree with him, that we do whatever necessary to keep Mike's web pages on the air, on the web. We'll look into that. A while back, right after Mike died, I had some correspondence with the provider in Switzerland who currently hosts the pages, and he sounds like a really great guy, and I'm sure we won't have any problem there, but we'll check and make sure. And if anybody else has any ideas about how to keep this kind of legacy site active, please let me know, and I'll pass the information around, because I think that would be a great tribute to Mike, and a great service to Solder Smoke fans and homebrewers around the world. I get occasional email from Mike's wife, and I imagine this must be a real tough time for her, but she is she's kind of hanging in there, and she tells me that she's interested in getting more involved in ham radio herself, and occasionally fires up the receiver and listens in. So we wish her the best, and I'll continue to exchange emails just to try to see how she's doing. All right. Well, one other thing. I thought, what would Mike want? Well, I mean, I'm sure he'd be very pleased that the show continues and people continue to listen. But he was also such a generous guy, and he always operated and worked in the best and most generous traditions of ham radio. So I think the best way to kind of pay tribute to Mike would be just to be as generous a radio amateur as he was. And if you come across somebody who needs a helping hand or a part or a magazine article or some technical advice, be as generous with your time and resources as Mike would have been. I think that's the best way to carry on with the KL7R approach to ham radio. So with that, I'll wrap up this edition of Solder Smoke. Thanks for listening. Keep those cards and letters and emails coming in. And I'll say 7-3 from Rome.